I walk down Skalitzer Straße. It is just past 2 o'clock on a grey January afternoon in Kreuzberg, my neighborhood in Berlin. The subway clatters on the tracks overhead. There are many people walking this way and that, all with pale, closed-up winter faces. As they walk, they keep their eyes fixed on the ground. I am so caught up in my thought that I barely notice a man walking about a block in front of me. Today is January 25, 1943. I only think about this evening. We are going to leave Berlin, my mother, my brother and I. We have been planning this escape for a long time now. We are going to meet up in the apartment one last time to finalize everything. If all goes well, these will be my last few hours in Berlin. What will things be like there, the place where we want to go? Better than here. That's what we think anyway. We hope so. It is our last hope. Our plan seems outrageous. It demands my full concentration. I'm only subconsciously aware that it isn't far now to number 32, our apartment building. Here comes a street lamp, just a few more steps. Suddenly, something doesn't feel right. I look up, the man walking in front of me. There's something about him I just don't like. I stare at his back, at his dark coat. Without thinking about it, I match the rhythm of his step. Their small, quick step, as he were cold. I'm afraid, but I don't know why. The man disappears into an entrance of an apartment building. It is the number 32. Instinctively, I clutch my handbag against my breast to hide the yellow star. Maybe I should just continue walking, I tell myself. But where to? I have to go home. I don't want to change any part of our plan. If I do, everything could fall apart. Number 32 is a normal Berliner apartment building, its ochre facade darkened by the rust from coal stove. I open the main door and walk towards the stairwell. It smells like linoleum and stale smoke. Our apartment faces the street on the second floor. The man is not in sight anywhere. Without hesitating, I walk up the stairs. Maybe I'm just too nervous. I find out soon that there was nothing to worry about. Suddenly, the man is no longer there. Perhaps he disappeared into another apartment. Or maybe he is visiting someone. Or he got the address wrong and will soon come back down the stairs. But then I see him. He's standing on the second floor landing, right in front of our apartment. He's leaning back against our door. I can't bear to look at him, so I stare at the imaginary point in space. I desperately want to turn around and go downstairs. But at this point, it is too late for that. I have no choice. My steps echo through the stairwell as I continue to walk like before, not slower, not faster. I keep my handbag clutched about my chest. Now I have to walk directly past him. I'm so close to him that he could touch me, but I don't look at him. With all I have, I try to appear unraveled. What does this man want? Why is he standing in front of our door? Whom is he waiting for? His face is no more than a light spot over a dark jacket that briefly crosses my line of sight. He doesn't move. I stop on the third floor. I have to make a quick decision. I ring the doorbell at an apartment. I barely know those neighbors, even though they live directly above us. They are not Jews, and I have never spoken to them before. Now I pray they are home. I hear somebody's steps inside approaching the door. Short, energetic steps. Heels clatter on the wooden floor. It is woman's steps. The door opens and my neighbor recognizes me immediately. I'm afraid she'll greet me aloud, but she remains silent, waves me in into the door and closes it behind her. Now it is clear to me that something terrible must have happened. I can see it in her eyes. She invites me into her living room and points me to a chair. I sit down and she takes a seat across from me. They were here, she tells me in a low voice, as if the man on the landing could still hear us. Gestapo. When, I ask, I hear my own voice, if it were far away. The room closes in on me, the light on the ceiling suddenly seems to grow dimmer, as if the bulbs were on the verge of burning out. This morning, she replies, a few hours ago, suddenly someone yelling in the stairwell, open up, open up, then clattering on the stairs. I went to the window, and they were just coming out the main door. They pushed them into the police car. Whom, do I ask? Mrs. Meissner, my neighbor says, and two others, a man and a woman, mid-twenties. I didn't recognize them. And the boy. My brother Ralf? My mother? The neighbor shakes her head. My mother wasn't home at the time. About an hour after the Gestapo disappeared, my mother arrived home. My neighbor explains. My mother found the apartment door sealed. I told her everything. Did she ask for me? I told her you weren't there either. Where's she now? Went to a neighbor's house, Juice, somewhere down the street. Immediately I know whom she is talking about. A Jewish couple we met in passing lives, three buildings down. So that's where she is, really close by. But I can't go where she is. Likely the man is still standing in front of our door. I can't leave. The only thing I can do is sit here and wait. The neighbor leaves me to my thoughts. I'm thankful that she doesn't insist that I leave. Like me, she sits there, elbows on the table, her hands holding her face. I barely know her. She can't help me. But it is good that she lets me stay. It is good that I'm allowed to be silent. Gradually it becomes afternoon. The bit of pale January sky that I can see through the kitchen window has become dark gray. At some point, I get up from my chair and say goodbye. I have to leave now. Doesn't matter if the man is still there or not. Slowly, I walk down the steps. He's no longer waiting in front of our door. Now, I can see the seal that's glued straight across the keyhole and the door frame. It's only when I'm out on Skalitzer Straße that the rigid numbness I've been feeling all day falls away. My mind is rushing. Everything has to be quick. I don't know how long I sat at my neighbor's, but it must have been more than an hour, maybe two. My mother is waiting for me. She must be getting worried. We have to think about what we can do now. We have to find my brother, or else go into hiding. No matter what happened, together we will find a way. I stand in front of the neighbor's building. In a moment, I will see my mother. It's getting darker. The Jewish couple is waiting at the lit-up window. I can recognize their silhouettes behind the curtains. I look for my mother's familiar form, but she's not there. The lady opens the door for me. Where is she? I ask out of breath. The woman waits until I'm inside, then she shuts the door. She left. At first, I don't understand. Did I get here too late? Is she out looking for me? She left a message for you. I'm waiting for the woman to hand me something, but she just stands there. I look for a slip of paper in her hand, something my mother would have written down for me. I'm supposed to give you a message. Then she tells me what my mother can no longer tell me herself. I have decided to go to the police. I am going with Ralph, wherever that may be. Try to make your life. Those were supposed to be her words. It felt like they had nothing to do with me. Cold words from a stranger's mouth. I looked quizzically at the woman. That's what she said, nothing else. Then she left. Try to make your life. She repeats the sentence. It's only hearing it for the second time that I get the meaning. A cruel sentence, hard and indifferent. I stand there with nothing but that sentence. I don't even have a single line in her own handwriting. Now the woman reaches for something on the chest of drawers in her entranceway. She presses this into my hand. I feel smooth leather. Only then do I see what it is. My mother's handbag. I open it. A familiar fragrance rises to my nose. It smells like brushed leather, perfume, and pencil leads. Like soap, wet coat and paper, like rainy days, her own personal fragrance. I reach into the purse and take out her little address book, a small notebook she had made from graph paper. The cover was of long time ago, on the edge an index and alphabet, in alternating red and black letters. Some letters are more worn than others. Many addresses are neatly written, fountain pens, others quickly scribbled in pencil. Addresses from travel agency, visa offices, consulates, and contacts who may be useful later. But there are more things inside her handbag. At the bottom, I feel something heavy, cool, smooth. I take it out. It is her amber necklace, a mid-length necklace of pieces of amber that have been polished to matte surface. The pieces increase in size towards the middle of the necklace. Some of the pieces are golden or mustard yellow. Others are darker, almost reddish. I close the handbag and walk to the door. There's no reason to stay any longer. The woman watches me. She doesn't stop me. She doesn't ask where I'm going. Auf Wiedersehen, I say. Auf Wiedersehen, she calls me from the doorway. We know there won't be any Wiedersehen. On the day I go into hiding, I take off my Jewish star. I stand on Skalitzer Straße. Automatically, I put one foot in front of the others. It has gone dark and very cold. I can spend the night on the streets, but where should I go? Where should I sleep? On a bench? I would freeze. I have to make a decision. I'm just 21 years old. I have never before made a decision all by myself. I don't have my own life yet. My life is a life with my mother, my brother, my family. Now that life is over. Why didn't my mother wait for me? I continue walking mechanically without a destination. Suddenly I'm standing without knowing how I got there in front of the apartment of Jewish friends. Ziggy Hirsch and his sister. I ring the doorbell. They're home. I can spend the night at their place. A few nights. My first nights in the underground. Early the next morning, I leave and walk through the January darkness, the underground. My life in hiding has been up until now nothing more than walking around aimlessly on the streets that I know well, but which suddenly seem strange and dangerous. From now on, I have to dread running into anyone who knows me. I drop my head when others come towards me, but no one notices me. The faces of passers-by are hidden behind scarves and collars. They're in a hurry. They're going to work. I go nowhere. I just walk. It's getting light outside. The bakeries and newsstands start to open up shop for the day. The other stores follow suit. At some point during the morning, I walk past a beauty salon. Except for the hairstylist, nobody is inside. She's sweeping the floor and waiting for customers. I make a decision. What can I do for you? She smiles at me. Get my hair dyed at once. I sit down on a stool. What color would you like? I think for a moment. Red, I say. I have my hair dyed Titian red. Jews don't have red hair, is what people think. I want to look non-Jewish. My black hair doesn't take the color well. My scalp burns. It hurts. But I definitely want to look different. I am no longer the Margot Bentheim I was yesterday. That Margot can't exist anymore. I'm gone underground. Try to make your life. I have to try. Today and every day of my underground life ahead, I must try to do what my mother told me to do. I spent the early morning somewhere out on the street. People were on the way to work. Everyone seemed so busy. They had places where they were expected to be. Whom could I go to? Who could help me? I only knew Jews. Then I suddenly hit me. Aunt Anna. Anna, who was looking out for our furniture. Her daughter Marion was only a month older than I was. Maybe she would understand me. I didn't know Aunt Anna especially well. She was a slender blonde woman with a small mouth. She didn't talk much. Everything about her was short and curt. She had always been a stranger in our family, maybe not only because she was Gentile, but because she wasn't German either. Aunt Anna came from Switzerland, but that was something that could be useful for me. A Swiss citizen, she had less to fear if she helped me. Perhaps she could hide me. My whole body shivered as I rang the bell at her door. Aunt Anna opened. When she saw me, she was speechless from surprise and forgot to ask me in. So we just stood there standing in the doorway. You're in Berlin? She asked then. I nodded. I thought you all were long gone. To Silesia. They picked them up, I said. My mother and Ralph. Anna startled. She briefly listened for a sound in the stairwell. Come in, she said then. I told her what happened in every detail, without a pause. The clearer I said what happened, the clearer it was to me what trouble I was in. This was my only chance. I wanted Aunt Anna to understand me, but I couldn't tell whether she was moved or sad as I spoke. Maybe I was hoping for something like a motherly reaction. She listened to me until I was finished without interrupting me. Well, Aunt Anna's face was immobile. What are you thinking? What should I do for you? That was a question I was waiting for. I want to live in hiding. She gently shook her head, disapprovingly, as if I have said something silly. Then, why are you here? She asked. I didn't understand her question. I don't have anyone else. How am I supposed to help you? I need a place to hide. If you aren't ready to help your mother, said Anne, I can't help you either. I didn't understand what she meant. She is at the Gestapo, I said. I can do anything for her. How am I supposed to help her? By going with her. I lowered my head if Anna had struck me. I expected consolation, sympathy. The whole time I had been fighting feelings of guilt. Now my aunt spoke aloud what I tried to hide, not to think. You left your mother in the lurch. You allowed her to go to Gestapo by herself. You did not have the courage to do the same thing she had done. I stood up. Only then did I notice that I have been sitting the whole time on our blue sofa. Anna had put it in her living room right after picking it up from us. It looked as if it had been always there. I couldn't look at Anna anymore. I didn't want to see her face. I left the apartment without another word. That evening, I returned to the apartment. Ziggy and his sisters are home, lucky again. During dinner, Ziggy hands me a folded piece of paper. That's the address, he says. Memorize it and throw the people's piece of paper away. The next morning, we say goodbye once more. We sense it will be the last time. On the piece of paper was the address of someone who wanted to hide me. I had 16 helpers, and I was in hiding for 1 year and 3 months. One door closes and another opens. One life ends and a new one begins. I'm ready to enter this new life. The journey there disappears into nothingness. My footsteps disappear even as I walk along. What kind of people am I going to? I've never seen them before, but in the coming days, weeks, months, they will be at the center of my life, maybe the people who will rescue me. I live for the moment, the next few hours, the following day. Every goodbye is a goodbye forever. The protectors I leave behind, I won't ever see again. I must forget their names, their addresses. The less I know, the less I can betray. What kind of people are they? I don't know them, understand them, don't know what drives them to help me. What do they want from me? What do I want from them? I don't doubt these helpful people. They are all opposed to Hitler. I know that. They are just people, not heroes. The apartment where I'm supposed to report now is on the mezzanine. I got the address from the last woman who hit me. It's the apartment of a single woman, she told me before I left. So I'm surprised when a man opens the door and casually lets me in. I walk down a long dark corridor to the left. The door leads into the kitchen and across from it another door leads into a large room with a balcony. Other rooms are off the hallway to the left and right, but the doors are closed. I walk into the room with a balcony. At first, I'm confused. The room is filled with people. Some are sitting around at a large table and are playing cards. One woman stands up and she sees me. She looks like late 40s. We walk toward into the hallway to that the others can't hear us. "Don't worry," she said. "Just act quite normally. No one knows who you are, and even if they suspect it, they won't care." She has a white, somewhat asymmetrical face and small, lively eyes. The guest room is all the way back on the left. After a few days, I understand the rule of my new hiding place. My host entertains a lot of visitors. She sits with her guests in the room with a balcony that hangs over the back courtyard. Around the big table, there's a sofa and many chairs and armchairs. They play cards and smoke a lot. One day, we have unusually large number of visitors, and cards are played as always. This time, an older gentleman is present whom I have seen a few times before. I know from my host that he's Jewish, but we don't speak to each other. It's almost if we avoid each other's presence, as if meeting each other could endanger us. All afternoon, guests come and go. The doorbell rings again, and because everyone else is busy, I go to the door. The light in the corridor isn't on. When I open the door, I recognize the silhouette of two men. Two men. Without even taking a breath, I close the door to just a crack and run back into the room with a balcony. I have to buy time. I run quickly to my host, Gestapo. I whisper into her ear. She immediately stands up and goes to the hallway to hold off the men. Next, I search for the older Jewish gentleman. He sits in an armchair in the corner and he's smoking a cigarette. "Come with me," I whisper. "The Gestapo is here." The man hesitates, then follows me towards the balcony. The apartment is on the mezzanine. Strange voices reach us from the hallway. They grow louder, slowly come closer. I go out on the balcony, climb over the railing, hold myself with both hands on the edge. Then I jump. My knees buckle. I land safely, glance up quickly, and see that the man is still standing in front of the balcony door. Our eyes meet, and then he looks away. He doesn't want to give me away. Someone calls him. I see his head disappear, and I squeeze against the side entrance. I could keep close up against the wall and leave the courtyard through the door that leads out to the street. But I'm afraid that the Gestapo is keeping watch there. I stay where I am and wait. It's already May, the air is warm, so at least I won't freeze. I wait a long time. At first, I still hear loud voices from the apartment. Then it gets quiet. At some point, someone whispers my name. It is my host. She leans over the balcony, searching for me in the courtyard. I walk out of the shadow of the entranceway. "Come back up," she says in a muffled voice. "They're gone." We sit down at the big table. My host, unusually so quiet and breezy, is pale from agitation. Her hands tremble as she reaches for a cup of tea. The tea has long grown cold. In the meantime, she drinks it anyway, in small sips. "They ask about you," she said, "about the girl who had opened the door." I said, "It was me." They didn't want to believe me. Then they inspected the papers of each one of us. and must have forgotten about you. We all had valid papers, except for our friends. Friend, they took him away. They had found a victim. Once again, I had been spared. Why? What hand had guided me? God's hand or my mother's? It's April. For almost 15 months, I've been living underground. There's a photo from this time showing me with Gretchen and Irmgard Kapler on Kurfürstendamm. Hugo probably took it. We are arm in arm, laughing at the camera. In the background, the glass showcases that recall pre-war times when the shop windows were filled with beautiful clothes. Somewhere in the picture in the back, someone is in uniform. We are squinting at the early spring sun, wearing coats, pieces, dresses, some clothes over our arm. We are laughing, but our faces are pale and exhausted. Probably we are coming directly from the bunker at the Soul Garden after a night of bombing. We make it just in time when the first bomb fell. We are already in the overfilled bunker. This time it doesn't take long. When all is clear, signal is given, we start off to go home. In the middle of the day, we still have a lot to do. We have almost reached the end of Joachimsthaler Straße when two young men come walking towards us. They walk slowly and show no sign of moving to one side. I had noticed one of them right away because he's so attractive, tall, dark, with black, lively eyes. I can't help but look at him. At that moment, both men are standing directly in front of us, blocking our way. "Your papers, please," says the handsome one. They don't seem like Gestapo official, but they are completely professionally keeping their eyes on us, and they wait for us to get out our identification papers. First, they focus on Hugo's brother. He digs around for a while in his briefcase. Both men observe him carefully. What should I do? Run away? This would be the right moment. The men are distracted. They aren't watching me. They're talking to Hugo's brother, who is still rummaging through his things. I hesitate, and then my chance is gone. Hugo's brother finds the necessary papers and presents them. Both men inspect them skeptically. When they're finished, they turn to Irmgard and Gretchen. They can prove their identity too. Then it is my turn. I take an identification card from the post office out of my handbag. It is pitifully small, rectangular piece of paper without a photo. I had it made a while before using the birth certificate that the two sisters had given me. The men didn't even think my post office ID is worth a glance. "We have to take you along to the station," the attractive one says, "for verification." Then he turns back to the Kampleers. "A friend of yours?" Irmgard shakes her head. "We just met," she says, "in the bunker at Zoo Station. We just decided to walk together for a bit. Is that it? Then goodbye." As she said that, she looks at me quickly and steadily in my eyes. Then they go on walking, all three of them. I don't look back at them. Any sign that we know each other can endanger them. The Kamplers turn the corner. I follow the two men. We simply walk away from each other without a goodbye. On the way to the station, I decided to tell the truth. I am Jewish, I say. I'm Jewish by saying that I was once again united with the fate of my family and all other Jews. No matter what happened to me now, I was no longer alone. This sense of being isolated, of I-ness, became we-ness. After 15 months in hiding, I again existed. The running and hiding was over. In the last few months, I had met many people who had helped me. I had even discovered friends. But those people had nothing to do with me, with my early life. Probably they won't never see them again. During the whole time, I had never spoken with a single Jew. I felt separated from my people's fate. Every day I felt guilty. Should I have gone with my mother and my brother? At least then I would have known what had happened to them. Now I almost felt relieved that it was over, and at the same time I was afraid of what was coming. The two men put me between them and led me in the direction of Kurfürstendamm. I tried to postpone the moment where there was no return back. We left the camp on Iranische Straße in a truck out of Berlin. The gates closed behind us. From that moment on, everything went by me like a nightmare that you forget immediately, but walking up from that nonetheless leaves an indelible feeling of fright. My soul was not in my body, not in the truck on the way to Theresienstadt. At some point, I registered that we were standing on a railway platform and were being loaded on a train. It wasn't a cattle car, but rather a very old, probably long retired train. The trip took a long time. How long? For that, I lost all sense of time. On June 6, 1944, our train arrived in Theresienstadt. We got out and went through the Schleuse, the sluice. We walked down gray streets. When I arrived in June 44, the camp was overfilled. It's true, there were constantly new transports to the east, but just as often, new trainloads of people arrived. Theresienstadt was a large, well-funded endeavor, an experiment. One question determined our lives. How much can a person bear? Theresienstadt was a middle ground, not life, not death. Death awaited us in the camps in the east, in the ghetto. There was hunger, filth, and crowding. Everyone fought as an individual. I yearned for empathy, for intimacy, but it was difficult for me to allow that myself. Everyone existed for himself in a kind of encapsulation. Theresienstadt was a vacuum, a place without air, without light, without time. Along the dusty streets, people scolded, who were people no longer, people with eyes that could no longer see. The ghetto emptied out. What had been oppressively crowded was now disturbingly empty and run down. after the transport of what had once been 29,000 inhabitants of Theresienstadt, only 11,000 remained. Within a month, they had hauled off 18,000 people. Silence. There was silence everywhere. It wasn't a good silence, but rather a threatening silence that further strengthened the feeling of being locked in. I felt more helpless than ever before. I walked aimlessly through the city, now died out. I was still firmly determined to survive, but the hope of a life after liberation was no longer real. It had become a dream. I wandered through the empty streets, the empty houses, the empty spaces. Where were all the people? Hanging from a nail was a dress that a woman had forgotten. A glass was sitting on the table if someone had just taken the drink from. A half-closed suitcase stood along bargain with tattered clothing. Many things had been left behind in the sleeping quarters. People had suffered so much that they didn't want to burden themselves once more time with a few things that still remained to them. Rooms with 2- and 3-level beds, usually overflowing with people, were now still and abundant. Only the dirt attested to the people who had lived here. Here and there were personal items, valuables too, a picture, a clock, a ring, rooms and sheds that had been put together with great effort by the inhabitants over months or years, now stood abandoned, empty, and pathetic. In many of the rooms, the light was still on, mostly just a weak light bulb hanging from a wire in the ceiling. Somewhere a faucet was running that someone had forgotten to turn off. The noise of the running water was unusually loud. The people were gone. They owned nothing more. I still had some pictures and some clothes. I had the small address book and the amber necklace my mother had left for me. I had so much more than the people who had been shipped off to the east. They didn't exist anymore. Only things they had left behind could still tell about them. One day a train slowly arrived in Theresienstadt. It was around April 20, 1945. Along with many others, I was taken from work and led to the train station. We watched as the train pulled in. Cattle cars, an endless row. I had no idea what this meant. The train moved forward meter by meter before its brakes brought it screeching to a halt. We didn't move. We stood there on the platform for minutes and waited. Then the doors were opened. They simply fell out or else were pushed out. People who were no longer people. Many were already dead, but the dead had to be distinguished from the living. Their eyes hung deep inside the sockets. Their cheeks were sunken. Only their noses stood out sharply from their faces. The people were wearing some kind of striped pajamas, but most were only tatters. From bare shoulders and arms hung rags of clothes that must have been jackets at some point. In place of shoes, they were wooden clogs. Hardly anyone had an intact pair of shoes. Most had only one shoe. Some had none at all. Many had edema in their legs, which swelled them up so much that they were like elephant legs. Something fell into my arms. It was a human being, so weak that I had to carry him. He was as light as a feather. These people came from Auschwitz. For the first time, we heard that name. Now we learned that the invisible trains also came from there. At that time, Auschwitz had just been liberated. We don't know a thing about it. The transports coming in now were made up of prisoners whom the SS had sent on a death march before liberation, around on January 27. The SS did all they could so that the survivors would not fall into the hands of the Russians, and so that the Allies would not find out the true dimension of the annihilation. For almost 3 months, these people had been underway, starting out in front in a long column. It was all men. Also, at first glance, they gave no impression of having a gender than skeletons do. The greater majority of them were long dead, shot, starved to death, or dead of exhaustion. At some point, the last survivors had been cleaned out, crammed into cattle cars, and sent to Theresienstadt, one of the last camps that not yet had been liberated. The trip went on for days in freight cars, without food, without light, mixed in with those sick with typhoid and in dreadful filth. Many had not survived it, but there were still hundreds who fell on us. At that moment, the East received a name. At that moment, we learned about the death camp. At that moment, I understood that I wouldn't see my mother and my brother again. It was incomprehensible that any one of them survived at all. Now the East not only had a name, instead it had a face as well, one that was no longer human and no longer alive. After liberation, I had seen the looks of those who had survived Auschwitz and the death marches. The eyes of each of them said more about the death camps than all the news about Auschwitz that we now learned from the Russians. I had no hope that anyone from my family was still alive. My mother's hand had guided me. That's what I said all these years. I stood under her protection so that I could survive. And I had done it. Now I had to accept the thought that my mother was dead. I had always felt she was close to me. Until now, try to make your life. Did that hold true up until now? Not longer. I had survived, but nothing was the way it had been before. Behind me lay my past, with only a few pictures, a few pieces of clothing, a small address book, and an amber necklace remaining to me. In front of me lay nothing. It works like that for everyone. We were the residue. Along with my cousin Annie Goldberger and her husband, my mother and my brother were taken to the reception camp on Große Hamburger Straße. Shortly afterwards, a transport to the East was put together. All four were aboard the trainport, which arrived in Auschwitz on January 29, 1943. How unimaginable
My mother, my brother's pain must have been when they were torn from each other only a few minutes after their arrival. Was there a last hug, a last look from a distance? How much time did my mother have for her final thoughts? That they both knew that they would not see each other again? That the mother's sacrifice to leave alone with her son had been in vain? The uncertainty about what happened to me must have given my mother terrible pain. I was her child too. These thoughts come back to me again and again. They never leave me. My inner struggle with guilt feelings as a survivor and the pain concerning my family's fate both follow me through life and cost me much strength. After I've been reading this to students, people, I asked them, are you surprised that I came back to Germany? The reason that I came back is to tell you about it. I want to reach out to you, but I want to tell you that these were people, human beings. And I speak for these people because they cannot speak for themselves anymore. I want to tell you that the blood in my vein is exactly the same as in yours. There is no Jewish blood, Christian blood, Arabic blood, or whatever, just human blood. You have no idea what 6 million were. Berlin has 3.5 million inhabitants. If you come out of your house one morning to go to school or wherever, and you don't see a single person in all big, big, big Berlin, and it is only 3.5 million, double the size, were killed. And that only of Jews. The word Holocaust was done for the Jews, for the 6 million. But there were many, many million more people who were political, had different ideas, homosexuals, small children who were born ill, were annihilated. Old people, senile, were killed. And this is what I want to tell you. You should be the Zeitzeugen, that is a word that is used for us who went through it. You must be the Zeitzeugen that we cannot longer, very much longer be. It is up to you that this should never, never, never happen again. And that's why I'm here, to tell you about it. I hope you understand me. I always know that I cannot reach all of you, but I reach. If I reach a few, I have done something good, because I speak for the one who cannot speak for themselves anymore. This is my mission, and that's why I went back to Germany.